Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And very many thanks for joining us again here on Africa Link. My name is Abubakar Jallo, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. In the next 25 minutes, a United Nations expert who is part of a three-man team investigating atrocities in Burundi, Christoph Haines, tells DW what they plan to do with their findings as their mission comes to an end.
We are calling on for the government of Burundi to take some concrete steps. So the concrete steps would include ensuring that opposition members are not targeted through violence.
About 5 million Somalis, that's nearly 40% of the population, face severe hunger, according to a new report by the United Nations.
The simple truth is that today in Somalia, the weight of climate variability, conflict and displacement is greater than the counterweight of people's resilience.
And a boom in tourism in Eritrea? Stick around to find out more on this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Now, United Nations investigators said on Tuesday that Burundi's government was behind systematic human rights violations, including execution and torture. The group of independent experts is calling for the creation of a UN panel to look further into a probe of gross human rights violations in Burundi. The three experts, commissioned by the UN Human Rights Office, recommended the establishment of a commission of inquiry into the atrocities. Christoph Haines is the organ's special rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary or arbitrary executions. Their mandate is about to come to an end, and in an interview with Africa Link's Eunice Wanjiru, he discusses some of their findings.
The most serious violations are executions, torture, disappearances, number of civil and political rights such as freedom of expression, assembly, association, socioeconomic rights as well. There are these serious violations and then nothing happens. And I think we're particularly concerned about the number of people who have fled, either internally displaced or have crossed the border. And there are almost 300,000 refugees since the crisis started in last year. And it seems to us that the crisis is not over and that these serious violations are continuing.
You have openly accused the government of Burundi for being behind the systematic killings and other violations. Do you have any names of the suspects?
Yes, we had a team on the ground for quite a number of months. They collected the evidence, for example, as far as disappearances are concerned. There are 12 names that came to the fore in particular, and other mostly government officials, their names concerning torture as well. So yes, we have quite an extensive list of reports to us, and in many cases, the same people are being accused.
You are calling for a UN panel to investigate further what you call gross human rights violations. What will the panel do differently than you did?
Well, I think in the first place to say that the international attention that has been paid to Burundi, I think, had some effect. And so in the first place, we are calling for a continuation because our mandate comes to an end now in September as the independent investigation into Burundi. So what we're calling for now is that a formal commission of inquiry will be established and that commission will continue with the work that we're doing and in particular also look at the issue of individual accountability.
In your recommendations, you have called for Burundi to be suspended in UN Human Rights Council. How will that help to change the situation in the country?
We call on the council to consider whether Burundi should continue, and it's obviously up to the council itself to decide. There are 47 states there, states that are supposed to have a good human rights record and set an example. And it seems problematic that a state with a record of Burundi is part of that decision-making body. But this is a process that we recommend, and certainly this is something which I think also assists states with taking their obligations seriously if they are members of these bodies.
And what is the next step after publishing your report?
For us, this is the end of our mandate. What we are calling on, I think what I should emphasize in the first place, is for the government of Burundi to take some concrete steps. So the concrete steps would include ensuring that opposition members are not targeted through violence or otherwise, also to ensure that inflammatory language and ethnically charged language is not used because it's a volatile situation. These are all steps that can be taken immediately, and also to ensure accountability. to investigate allegations. We are, of course, not a court of law. We cannot investigate and say this or that person is guilty, but we can say there's a strong case to be made and that should be investigated further.
Christoph Hain, the UN's Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, speaking about their findings on the violence and political stalemate in Burundi. To South Africa now, students and campus security guards clashed outside the Great Hall Auditorium at Wits University in Johannesburg on Tuesday, hurling rocks at each other. Unrest has hit many South African universities over the past year as students protest fee increase, which they say is forcing those who cannot afford the fees out of school. DW's Tuzo Komalo in Johannesburg tells Eunice Wanjiru what the situation was like on Tuesday evening.
The situation on the ground is really bad. Students are protesting in almost the majority of universities in South Africa. What we saw in Johannesburg at Wits, Witwatersrand University, we saw students clashing with police and security officers, and police had to use stun grenades. And in other universities, lessons had to be suspended and others have shut down. And students are saying they will not back down until the government gives them an assurance that it's going to give them free education.
We reject all fee increments. We are protesting for free quality education, a realization of it, a commitment for it. We are saying that we do not want just the increments to be covered, but their race fees, their school fees, their eating allowances. We do not want students to graduate with debt. We are tired of talking because we've been engaging the whole year.
So what really brought about the clashes between the students and the security guards?
In fact, last year when students protested, the government gave them an assurance that the government is going to look at their plea for free education and that no fee increase for 2017. But on Monday, the education minister, Blade Nzimande, came on air and made an announcement to students that there's going to be an 8% increase across all universities, saying the poor students will be exempted. So this angered a lot of students, and when the students advanced to the premises to protesting and marching, wanting to gather in one of the university halls, security tried to prevent them and the police because fearing that they might destroy the property.
And what are the other issues being raised by the students apart from fees falling or removal of fees?
The main issue really with the students, they are saying they believe the government can afford to just a no fee. They believe free education is possible and the government can do it. So they're adamant that that is their first demand.
So what is the government's reaction?
The government has to go back to the drawing board because I think the government had assumed that 8% increase will be acceptable to students, but they've rejected it. But the government insists now, saying if no fees were to be increased next year in the 2017, considering that there was no fee increase again 2016, these universities will collapse. The quality of education will go down. So the government is saying that is unaffordable. In fact, at the 8% increase that the government announced, the government will still have to look for over 2 billion rands to try and cushion the universities for not allowing them to go beyond the 8%. So for the government now, they've got to go back to the drawing board because the students are saying if their demands are not met, all universities will shut down and no learning will take place until the government agrees that there won't be any fee increases in 2017.
Tuzo Komalo in Johannesburg speaking about the clash between students and campus guards on Tuesday over increasing school fees.
News, analysis and feature reports, all that here on Africa Link.
Now, about 5 million Somalis, that's more than 40% of the population, do not have sufficient food. This is according to an assessment report by the United Nations Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit. The report, which was released on Tuesday in the Kenyan capital Nairobi, blames the shortages on poor rainfall as a result of the weather pattern El Nino and other factors such as increasing internally displaced persons as a result of atrocities by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. DW's Andrew Wasike has more from Nairobi.
The United Nations, the Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit, and the Famine Early Warning Systems Network released an assessment report in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, on Tuesday. The humanitarian organizations announced that 5 million Somalis are food insecure, with more than 1 million people from that number facing acute food security crisis. Food and Agriculture Organization's representative in Somalia, Richard Trenchard, said the situation has been gradually worsening since 6 months ago.
That's a terrible situation, and it's 20% worse than it was just 6 months ago. Malnutrition too has worsened in many of the areas that were surveyed. The simple truth is that today in Somalia, the weight of climate variability, conflict and displacement is greater than the counterweight of people's resilience.
Trenchard adds he had witnessed the effect of drought and starvation with his own eyes while working in Somalia, thus calling for action.
When you see the barren, arid landscapes, the carcasses of lost livestock, and the homesteads completely stripped of assets, it's incredible. Indeed, it's a miracle that anyone is able to withstand these repeated shocks.
Abdirizak Noor from the organization Famine Early Warning Systems Network added that nearly 4 million people are in need of support and called on international donors to step in to alleviate the situation.
Rainfall started late and ended early, and the amounts were poor to or below average. We estimate over 300,000 children to be acutely malnourished, including over 50,000 that are severely malnourished and in urgent need of nutrition support. There is an urgent need to provide nutrition support for acutely malnourished women of reproductive age, which, as part of our assessment, have found to be in dire situation. They are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance.
FAO says the current drought in Somalia will be followed by another season with poor rainfall based on weather forecasts from the IGAD region. Trenchard again.
We cannot rely upon chance to avert future disaster. The food security and nutrition situations in Somalia are projected to worsen in the coming months. The 1 million and 5 million lines will once again be crossed. This is simply not good enough.
Kenya plans to close the Dadaab refugee camp, which is home to more than 320,000 Somalis. Abdirizak Noor said that humanitarian agencies have warned that sending back home the Somali people will further worsen the state of food security, causing hundreds of thousands to face starvation.
Nearly 60% of the 1.1 million who need urgent humanitarian assistance are internally displaced persons. The imminent closure of Dadaab could mean possibly these numbers are growing. So the more flow of refugees could exacerbate the situation.
The humanitarian agencies say that even though many are displaced due to attacks by Al-Shabaab militant group, the Somali government needs to address underlying causes of food insecurity and malnutrition through an agricultural system that can feed Somali people and enable them to respond to shocks and crises.
DW's Andrew Wasike in Nairobi. And still to come, a booming tourism industry in Eritrea. How will they manage it? But first, Nollywood, Gollywood, Riverwood or Wakaliwood. Well, so much for woods in African film industries. How are they faring, actually? Stick around to find out.
Behind the headlines.
The film industry in Africa is blossoming with more original stories coming from the continent. Nollywood in Nigeria revolutionized, I'm afraid, African storytelling through film. And Ghana's Gollywood is trailblazing with exciting folktales. They have inspired other countries to come up with their own film industries, such as Riverwood in Kenya and Wakaliwood in Uganda. Outside the continent as well, there is still a great interest in African films, as demonstrated in the African Film Festival currently ongoing in Cologne, Germany. Wanjiku Mwara was there and filed this report.
I'm at Museum Ludwig in Cologne, Germany, where the Africa Film Festival Cologne is taking place. People are gathered as they wait for the 14th edition of the Africa Film Festival to start. This year, the focus of the film initiative is Sisters in African Cinema. Esther Donko, an organizer, explains the process of choosing the films.
On the focus Sisters in African Cinema, we picked 33 movies out of 90. And besides that, we also had so many other film suggestions. And now we have 83 films chosen on the festival.
The venue picked for the festival seems symbolic. Museum Ludwig has one of the biggest collections of Picasso and other contemporary art created after the year 1900. This blends well with the fact that African cinema is also fairly young. For a long time, Africa was used as an exotic backdrop for Western films. Now, filmmakers like Nasib Farah can tackle themes like extremism in Africa by detailing the story of young men who leave the Western countries to join the Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Farah, who is originally from Somalia, now lives in Denmark.
Most of the people who are going back to Somalia is Somalian, their own young people who have parents from Somalia, but there are also Danish people who are going there. I want to understand why they're doing that and why they leave from the rich country and they're going the poorest country in the world. So I want to understand. That's why I just want to follow young people I know from my suburb in Denmark.
Even as the film industry in Africa grows, some of the participants in the festival in Cologne wish there was a better reception of films made in Africa by Africans. Judy Kibinge, a Kenyan filmmaker and founder of the East Africa Documentary Fund, explains more.
I think one of the most unfortunate things about our filmmaking is that we just haven't cracked distribution on our continent. I think it makes additional work for some of us.
So what can be done to change this? Teddy Goitom, an Ethiopian-Eritrean filmmaker based in Sweden, says that creatives in different African countries are already building an audience by organizing local screenings where his documentary series titled Afripedia has been screened.
Many times films that are produced in various countries in Africa, people never get the chance to see them. It's always shown in the West.
The focus of Sisters in Film Cinema highlights stories told by female directors and actors. And for many, this will motivate other African filmmakers to tell their stories, as Mante Gavtot Sileshi Soyom, an Ethiopian filmmaker, points out.
You can feel that the African woman filmmaker have a capacity and power to show their problem, not through the man, but by themselves. So it can motivate other African filmmakers to show their problems themselves.
Initiatives such as the Africa Film Festival introduce African films to new audiences. It provides platforms for work that would normally not be shown on big screens. However, it also highlights some challenges in African cinema, as Judy Kibinge explains.
To be honest, the fact that festivals like this are so important because it's really hard to see some of these films. Often we create these amazing labors of love that will show in 1, 2, 10, 20 festivals, but hardly be screened at home. I just wish we could actually pick up this whole week and, as well as having it tour Germany, I wish it could tour the continent.
As film festivals like this one create international platforms for African films, the untold stories continue being produced. This demand may improve distribution, marketing, and consumption of African films by Africans.
Wanjiku Mwawa reporting. Learning by Ears Crime Fighter series is back. Join us on Monday next week for a new exciting episode on cybercrime.
I can't believe anyone would stab Zawadi. She's the sweetest person I know, the best friend I've ever had.
There was this guy called Zake on Twari, you know, the social media website.
So you think this man, Zake, stabbed Zawadi?
There has been an increase in cybercrime lately, and crimes related to social media use.
Oh my goodness! Are those pictures of Zawadi?
Crime Fighters.
Well, hope you are as stoked as I am for that upcoming episode. And now back to news business. And speaking of which, Eritrea, a country in East Africa known for its disastrous image. It's ruled by one of the hardest dictatorships in the world, and right groups claim that there is no freedom of expression and there's mandatory military service which could last for decades. Still, the country hopes to attract tourists. The potential is huge, though, given its long Red Sea coast and, of course, the unique architecture of the capital Asmara, which could soon be declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Linda Staude was in Asmara, and her report is now presented by Helen Sini.
The lunchtime rush is on at the Sweet Asmara Cafe. Three elderly men are debating loudly over hot, sugary tea. At the next table, two young women indulge in treats from the sumptuous cake counter. The bar is done out in 1930s decor. From the gleaming coffee machine, the barista, Sarah, can quench your every caffeinated desire, dispensing cappuccinos, espressos, macchiatos.
Restaurants do it as a culture because the Italians do it the same thing before. That's why we use it until now.
Eritrea's former colonial rulers didn't just bequeath a fondness for strong coffee, chic bars and pasta. The architectural heritage of the Italians is visible all over town in Asmara.
Asmara, you see, is full of different styles of architecture built during the Italian colonial period. They never thought they live Eritrea. So they were building Rome or something like their own in very short time, in 14 years.
Art Deco, neoclassicism, Novecento, fascist modernism. Asmara has it all, explains Kepra Abzembele. He's an architect working for the Asmara Heritage Project. From 1935 to 1941, thousands of buildings were constructed in the city, most reflecting modernist styles and unique architectural ideas, such as petrol stations mimicking aeroplanes and boats, cinemas with fine period plasterwork, and government buildings with monumental designs. The town goes back more than 1,200 years. But the colonial building boom of the 30s has made Asmara truly unique. Dubbed Piccola Roma, Africa's Little Rome, the city is making a bid for UNESCO World Cultural Heritage status.
Asmara is the outstanding universal value. Asmara is the city. It has the values, that is the architecture, the urban context. We are very confident we are going to satisfy their requirement.
Enthuses Medhane Teklamariam. The project manager proudly presents long shelves packed with historical documents, architectural plans, colourful original sketches from the 30s and 40s, all perfectly preserved and carefully archived. Asmara's huge Medabar market. Craftsmen hammer away, creating metal goods. Huge ovens and storage tanks are stacked ready for sale. Young women grind fresh, aromatic spices. And then there are the hopes pinned on tourism.
We have safety. He can move by camel, by car, by Land Cruiser, and walk in. And if there is people they interested about diving, we have sea. And if there is people they about the culture, we can have different culture, different people.
Says hotel manager Solomon Abraha. Architect Kebra Abzembele, too, is convinced that the sights of Africa's Little Rome are worth a few minor discomforts.
I always admired Asmara's buildings, like the Italian buildings, because I grew in Asmara. This is what is unique about Asmara, the harmony of the buildings. Asmara is lucky. It's not disturbed. It is as it is 100 years.
That report was compiled by Linda Staude.
Opinion.
And for opinion, we look at Burundi, where a group of independent experts are calling for the creation of a UN panel to go on with a probe of human rights violations in the country. Do you think the suspects found so far should be prosecuted? We also reported about the clash in South Africa between students and campus guards in demonstrations over higher fees. Do you think the government should drop the fees? Do send us your comment via text message to +49 160 957 59510, in an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or send us a letter to AfricaLink DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. And now a reminder of some of the main stories we've covered for you. Independent experts are calling for the creation of a UN panel to look further into a probe of gross human rights violations in Burundi. South African students and campus security guards clashed in Johannesburg, hauling rocks at each other as demonstrations over higher fees turned violent. For more stories, go to our website dw.com/Africa. And until tomorrow, this is Abubakar Jallow in Bonn. Bye now.